Oh, he's the alien guy, right? He did all the
Yeah.
concept art. Oh
That's what I
man.
was, that's why I was talking about biomechanical vaginas a little
Okay,
bit. I
I
mean,
was
that's a
like,
normal conversation coming from my mouth, but
yeah, pretty much. I
not
was like,
but
it's not a normal Monday night if Richard doesn't talk about biomechanical vagina.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me today, as always, is my co-host Richard Wally.
Yes, and from sunny California and LA area, Cassidy Robinson. There's one other person, though.
We have a guest today. Today we're going to be reviewing The Hunger Games Part 4.
Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games. The Hungry, Hungry Hippo Games. With us today is a friend, a personal friend of Richard Wally, and a writer, and I guess supposed expert on the YA sci-fi fantasy genre, Mindy Crouchley.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome to the show. Welcome
Thanks.
To the show officially now.
Yes. I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. So a little background on you, since I never got to meet you personally. I went to Portland and met a lot of Richard's friends, but you guys were indisposed for whatever reason. So quickly,
I believe she was what we call pregnant.
Yeah.
It's this affliction that afflicts women sometimes.
Right. The 9 months
for about
disease.
9 months.
Yeah.
How did you meet Richard?
Funny story. The first time I met Richard, I do not remember. I did not remember, and then I met him again. So the first time that I met Richard was actually at a comic book convention. He was the minion, the volunteer dispatched to the table of the writer. He was like a writer on a Mass Effect comic, and I came up and like freaked out, and I was like really excited to like meet him and see his Mass Effect comic books, and then like a month later, or maybe it was that same month, my husband and I went to Things from Another World. They were having a like Firefly celebration. It's like the 15th anniversary of the one season of that TV show that everyone likes.
Right.
And there was a Serenity crafting contest where you made a tinfoil Serenity, and Richard and his lovely wife Jackie were across the table from us, and we bonded over a tinfoil Serenity.
That's and then, a lovely story,
isn't it? And I didn't realize that I had previously met Richard until like Dan later on was like, "Yeah, like we totally ran into that guy before," and I was like, "Oh, right."
He was the weirdo at the convention, remember?
Yeah, that's me.
I was busy like fangirling over Mass Effect, so like I was very zoned in on Garrus Vakarian in a comic book. So
sure.
Like you do.
one question about this at the event, the Firefly event, was Richard wearing his onesie?
I don't believe so.
But
yeah,
you've seen
remember.
It.
I don't think so.
Oh God.
You know what I'm talking about.
Wait,
yeah.
Wait, you have a onesie?
No, I don't have a onesie.
Oh,
I have a jumpsuit.
On.
It's way better.
Okay.
It's a tactical onesie.
I'm sure I've seen you in it before.
Yeah, I wear it to the Star Trek party event thing.
Yes. Okay. That's mm-hmm. where I've seen Richard in his onesie.
With the patches on it.
Yes.
That his
yes.
mom sewed on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's true, actually.
Oh, that's so sweet.
She's really good, so I feel bad when I have friends do it and then make my mom redo it because it's way better.
Right.
Well, now I know where to go if I ever need patches sewn onto my my onesie.
Yeah,
there you go.
Just got to drive like 750 miles is all. It's an 11-hour drive.
Worth it.
Super convenient. Well, yeah, Richard explained to me before we had you on.
Mm-hmm.
that you are self-published.
Yes, I'm in the
process. Author.
I'm not published yet. My book is circulating in what I refer to as copyright hell. Okay. we submitted it, I don't know, like 2 months ago, and we still, I guess the process could take up to 6 months. So, it's currently like in the world of self-publication. I have it up on a website, called Inkshares, where people can like buy a copy of it, but it has to hit like a certain threshold before they'll actually publish it. So I'm kind of attempting several different routes to get it self-published. Okay. This is my first time self-publishing. So yeah, if that doesn't work out with Inkshares, I think I'm just going to go the self-publishing route. I went to a couple workshops here around Portland and kind of vetted this publishing company called Inkwater Press that I think would be really good. So, yep, it's in the works. It's happening.
That sounds really cool. And do you want to explain maybe just a little bit of what it's about? And we'll include a link on our Facebook and Twitter so that people can buy your book if they'd like to.
Awesome. Yes. So it's a dystopian young adult fiction because that's all the rage these days.
It's hot.
It's the end thing. So yeah, it's got all sorts of exciting things. It's got terrorism and nanotechnology and it's centered around this young woman who loses her parents and like half of her body parts in a terrorist bombing in Paris, which I wrote this like 5 years ago. So the timing on this is really sort of unfortunate and I guess a little bit prescient. So I'm like, right. I don't know. I was just talking with Dan about like, should we go forward with publishing this given like what has happened lately? And he's like, yeah, of course. Like, you know, it's timely. So I don't know. We'll see how that plays when an editor gets a hold of it. But
That's totally interesting though. I mean, like, yeah, it's kind of a bummer and everything. Like I even was, we'll get into it when we talk about, Hunger Games, but I was even kind of like feeling more than I probably should at a Hunger Games movie because of current events.
Exactly. I definitely, when I watched it on a Friday night, that was really resonating with me as well. I was like very emotional, much more emotional than I think I would have been given different circumstances. So,
right.
So yeah, there's like this, it's a very weird connection to current events that I did not foresee when I wrote this book 5 years ago. And so this girl is basically given kind of new life by this global corporation, shady global corporation, and conscripted into national service.
Mm-hmm.
So she goes into like basically kind of like a boot camp to become a soldier. And then from there, meets, you know, a group of friends and they're kind of racing this Prothero organization. Cause it's sort of, you know, it's one of those seedy global corporations and they're kind of doing weird things. They think they're kind of tied to the spread of this nanovirus. So they're trying to find a cure to the nanovirus. So yeah, it's kind of got a lot of interesting elements.
I'm sold.
Yeah. No, thanks.
At my job, I write little news blurbs for all of the different stories that are news stories, entertainment stories that are popping up all day in the trades. And about two or three of these kind of YA novels, either that have been published or are in the process of getting published, are constantly being optioned. Right now, because it's such a popular thing. And your elevator pitch for that sounds at least 2/3 more interesting than most of them that I write about.
Oh, yay.
Which is usually just some take on Twilight minus a give or take some of the finer details of the world building.
Yeah.
Well, yours sounds a lot more science fiction based.
Yeah.
I was thinking more of like,
I was getting a RoboCop.
Yeah, sort of like Bionic Woman, RoboCop. I mean, there's definitely a lot more sci-fi elements to it. And there's some romance, but it's not like the love triangle. I'm not really into that.
Is this where we get into the biomechanical vagina stuff I was talking about before?
You caught me. That's like, damn it, Richard. That was
Segway. Yeah, I ruined it.
That's a whole chapter on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Entire chapter on it. Okay, well, now that we've met you properly, let's go ahead and get into the show. And we'll do a couple news items here, and we'll kind of read these stories off to you, and you can give us your opinion. And Richard, I'll let you start.
So I'll start with the Martin Scorsese one. So how's that sound?
Sounds great.
So apparently he's going to be with William Monahan. I guess they're going to, who he did Departed with, just, you know, side note. Mm-hmm. They're looking into adapting like a Evel Knievel movie.
Sorry.
everybody laughs when I say that. But also Darren Aronofsky is doing one.
Right.
With Channing Tatum.
Sorry.
So
I have to giggle when anyone says Channing Tatum
with a whole other, you know, Darren Aronofsky, like that right. Seems like a weird marriage too. But
well, actually, as far as I've read, Aronofsky jumped off of that project.
Oh, did he?
But Tatum is still connected to it, and they're just it's just kind of in development hell, lingering until they can kind of put all the pieces together. I mentioned before we started the show that there's actually two other Evel Knievel biopics in the works. And this is the latest third entry into, you know, who's going to make it first, I think, is sort of what they're daring each other to do.
Did he just like die or something? I guess like what, why now? Like what?
I think Evel Knievel died a while ago. I want to say he died like in the early 90s, late 80s, something like that.
Well, we have this like thing called the internet. We could probably just look that up.
Wikipedia that. But yeah, no, I don't know. Yeah, I think people, you know, he's a known name. He was more known for people, I would say, 35 years and older. But maybe there's something there they think they can drum
up. He died in 2007.
Oh, there you go. So it was somewhat recently.
Okay.
But yeah, no, I think that, you know, the idea is just to get a movie about him out there, and I think these different production companies are trying to race to see who's the first one to do it. It's going to end up being like Jobs versus Steve Jobs.
Right. Well, the one thing, though, I have heard some like personal stories of Evel Knievel, and he's kind of a weird con man bastard before the Evel Knievel people knew about. So I think there could be an interesting story there, because he was just, I mean, you got to think about the type of guy that's willing to jump a motorcycle. I mean, he was Jackass before there was Jackass.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, really. Jumping a motorbike over a canyon, that's insane. It's also how I want to die, but.
So basically Martin Scorsese is going to direct a movie about one of the Jackass guys.
But from the 70s.
Right.
But it's Martin Scorsese, so I mean, you can't go wrong.
That's true.
Well, and one of the other details about this story versus the other ones is the book that they're going from in this one was apparently really hated by Knievel. And I guess he like attacked the writer with a baseball bat for writing it at one point.
See, I told you he's kind of a crazy dude.
So this version might be more like a warts and all kind of like, you know, contentious version of his life story.
Okay, I can see that much better for Scorsese too.
Yeah.
If it's got a baseball bat, you know, he wants to direct it.
Right. And it'll probably be Leonardo DiCaprio playing him.
Oh, of course. Who else?
The first story I have here is Matthew McConaughey is eyed to star in Stephen King's The Dark Tower. The studio who's making the movie has only kind of approached him and his people, and he has the choice to either play the hero, the gunslinger, or the villain. And I guess McConaughey's people are saying that he's leaning closer to the villain because he's more interested in playing the dark side. Now, I've never read the book, so I don't know a lot about it, but what are your impressions?
You've read more than I have of that series, Mindy. Why don't you give that a go?
I have a thing with Matthew McConaughey, which is that I don't really like him unless he's like a surly drunk man. Mm-hmm. So I feel like the villain, or I feel like there's a character, I think his name is Ed, who's a drug addict. I think he could pull that off. I guess he could do the gunslinger too. I don't know.
But you're leaning close, like McConaughey, you're leaning closer to him playing the villain.
Yeah, I feel like he could grasp that a little bit better. Like, he's just, when he tries to just be himself, he's just comes off as sleazy. So, right. So I don't see him in like a gunslinger type role. I think he could, I think the man, it's the Dark Man or something. I don't know.
Man
or
in
the
Black?
The Man in Black. Is that his name? Get the article. Yeah. So that, or like the character of like the drug addict. Cause I just like to see, Matthew McConaughey addicted to things and generally being an asshole. Like that's sort of, I think, his bread and butter. He's good in that
role. Right. From what I remember from the Dark Tower series, the only thing I really remember from those books, because it was so long ago, was them eating burritos around a fire.
Yeah.
And that it seemed like it happened a lot.
Yeah.
And so I could
have beans.
I could see Matthew McConaughey doing that. So that was my first reaction. Maybe not the best one, but it was mine.
It's in his skill set to eat a burrito next to a fire.
Yeah. Oh, man.
He can do
it. With like a cigarette dangling out of his mouth.
Right.
I mean, he is essentially
also chugging a beer.
Yeah, he's essentially the Marlboro man, like just like stepped out of the commercial and came to life.
Talking about how the earth is a flat circle and
all of that
stuff. Well, yeah, I was earlier today, I was listening to our last Hunger Games episode so I could remember some of the details from Mockingjay Part 1.
Mm-hmm.
And during the new segment in that episode, we had announced that Matthew McConaughey was being eyed to play the villain, like devil guy in an adaptation of The Stand. So I don't know if that's still on the table or what happened to that news, but
like a film adaptation or
a feature film adaptation. It's not instead of like a TV movie.
Yeah, they were talking about a trilogy at the time, okay. Or two movies or something like that.
Yeah, they were going to split it up, I think, into a trilogy at the time. So that might still be a thing. But if he does this, I don't know. I guess it's not like the Marvel Universe where you can't be Captain America and Johnny Storm at the same time.
Yeah, you can't. One is clearly a step down from the other. I'm not going
to say which.
I love you, Chris Evans. Anyway.
All right, Richard, do you want to do this Shadow movie with Edgar Wright?
Oh, I thought we were only doing two. You lied to me again.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, we can do that. Sure. Edgar Wright, he does things sometimes when he doesn't drop out.
Burn, Ant-Man, burn!
Yeah, not really, because I actually like Marvel and I like Edgar Wright. So apparently he's doing like a DreamWorks animation about in some weird shadow land. I can only imagine shadow puppets, but it's called Me and My Shadow and stuff. I don't really know much about it, but I guess Bill Hader and Josh Gad are attached as voice casting.
Well, here's the skinny. DreamWorks Animation was going to make a movie called Me and My Shadow with Bill Hader and Josh Gad. And that was, a project that had been developing for a while. And then for whatever reason, it got scrapped.
Mm.
And so now the only thing that's lingering from that project is DreamWorks wants to do a cartoon about shadows. And they've gone to Edgar Wright to write and direct it. So he kind of has carte blanche to do whatever the hell he wants to do within this concept.
So my dream of what he should be making could happen, is what you're telling me.
No, probably not.
I want to know what your dream is, Richard.
The shadow.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah.
The Pulp character. Yeah. Because that would be badass. He could get his whole Ant-Man thing out of him, mm-hmm. and he could, you know, make a badass little animated movie. I mean, they wouldn't do that because they don't sell those to adults.
Right, but. And I don't think that they have the rights to do the shadow. Those might even be tied up somewhere. Who knows? But, I kind of feel like this is going to be sort of like their maybe kind of sort of answer to Inside Out. Like, just kind of like something esoteric and not really tangible. Like doing a story about fish or doing a story about sea turtles or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, it's good luck. I mean, that movie I'm sorry. Yeah, I know what you're saying, and I can see them trying to do that and try to get to that realm. But well, I don't know. Attaching somebody like Edgar Wright, who can be very exciting and often is, I can't say I've seen anything that I don't like of his.
He's never done an animated film before, but his movies, his live action movies, are very animated. If that makes sense.
Like Scott Pilgrim was like.
That's about half and half.
Yeah,
but no, I mean, even like if you look at like his earlier films, like Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, and his aggressive camera use and his, you know, his fight sequences, like they're not there, but you can almost imagine like a zip pow kind of thing happening because, you know, he really kind of milks the fight sequences for their sort of cartoonish joy. So I could see him doing animation and really kind of getting into it. Or it could be a really, really frustrating experience because it's a lot easier to point a camera at something and, you know, get a lot of footage in one day than it is to write it out, storyboard it, and then have it animated for months and months and months before you can even look at what it's going to look like. Do you have an opinion, Mindy?
I mean, I love Edgar Wright movies. So I would be excited to see what he would come up with. I mean, I don't know what this Me and My Shadow is. I guess I can't see it being like a very dark movie. I don't think Edgar Wright, you know, like he's got a lot of humor and life in his stuff. So I mean, I would be really interested to see what he comes up with. I love him and I would probably watch whatever.
No, I agree. Yeah. Okay. Well, that pretty much gets us through our movie news. And I'm going to review a movie that I saw that neither of you were able to see in Portland. So I'll hurry up and get Carol. I'll hurry up and get my review of Carol out of the way. So Carol is the new film directed by Todd Haynes, who also did the movies I'm Not There, which was like his Bob Dylan biopic starring like eight different people playing the part. One of the last films he did. He also did a movie called Far From Heaven, which is like his ode to Douglas Sirk melodramas from the 1950s. And Carol is very much a companion piece to that. It takes place in the 1950s. It's based on a Patricia Highsmith novel. And the basic premise is Rooney Mara plays kind of a mousy, unassuming 1950s girl. Think first season Elizabeth Moss of Mad Men. Teresa Belvitt, and she's working in kind of a department store and trying to upsell a train to this kind of tired, world-weary upper-class woman named Carol, played by Cate Blanchett, and some sparks begin to fly between the two, despite the fact that they're living in 1950s America and they're both sort of involved. Carol is in the process of a divorce with Kyle Chandler, who knows that she's not straight and has his suspicions, but they're living in such a closed-lipped society that they can't even really have a discussion about that. And she's kind of like fighting for custody of their 5-year-old daughter. Rooney Mara is dating this kind of poor sap who she can't really commit to for obvious reasons. And she's trying to sort of figure herself out. Her and Carol end up becoming closer and closer as the movie progresses. They take a road trip. But both of them have so many personal dramas going into the burgeoning of this relationship that it's kind of damned from the beginning. So like I said, given the subject matter and also given the fact that it's largely a female cast and given the fact that it's Todd Haynes, who's already expressed a lot of interest in Douglas Sirk melodramas from the 1950s, movies like All That Heaven Allows or Whispers or, Whispers.
Which is the one that we watched?
We watched his remake of Imitation of Life.
Okay. Todd Haynes or the Douglas Sirk?
Douglas Sirk. Yeah.
Okay.
Todd Haynes film we reviewed on this podcast before was called Velvet Goldmine.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which is a very different kind of movie than this one. This one is very stately and very composed, and it's a society of manners. So everybody is brimming with emotions and brimming with all of these grand statements they want to make, but they can't.
No Iggy Pop then.
No Iggy Pop. Yeah, you don't have Ewan McGregor with glitter jizzing all over the crowd.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, that was much more. It sounds much more interesting when you have Ewan McGregor coming on the crowd with glitter.
That's what every movie needs, really.
Right, exactly.
Cut my interest.
I think the big difference between this movie and Far From Heaven, which I said it was kind of stylistically a kind of a sister film, is Far From Heaven really goes for the big emotions and goes for the grandiosity of a Douglas Sirk melodrama and the big sweeping camera movements. And there's a little bit of that here, but I think sort of what he's playing around with is that while there's all these big emotions to be had, nobody is allowed to express them. It's a little bit more realistic, even though the production design is gorgeous. The cinematography is very stylized in its own way and color corrected and all of that kind of stuff. This is one of the better Rooney Mara performances I've seen. I've enjoyed her, generally speaking, and she can show a lot of range. She plays interior very well, and she gets to do plenty of that here. Cate Blanchett is you know, effortlessly just kind of steals the entire movie, really. As soon as that first sequence when we see her flirting with Rooney Mara at the counter of the convenience store, the audience falls in love with her just as fast as Rooney Mara's character does, because she just exudes Cate Blanchett awesomeness. Kyle Chandler gets to play like gruff and frustrated really well, which he's made a career of doing. Yeah, I really like this movie. I will say that I think you have to either have an interest in 1950s kind of melodramas and or Todd Haynes' previous work and or these kind of romance stories in general and tragedies. Like, yeah, I don't think this maybe is for everybody, and I can see some people not being as excited about it, but I thought that it was a very well-made, studied film in the genre that it's doing. It's not my favorite Todd Haynes movie, and I think that it's so formally interested that it comes off as a little cold. I did enjoy it. And it's a good Christmas movie.
Okay. I liked both the movies you mentioned that we'd watched, the Douglas Sirk one and the Todd Haynes one, but it sounds more or less a little boring to me. I mean, is there anything that would catch my interest specifically?
Are there any explosions?
Yeah. Are there any aliens,
right,
robots,
murderers? At the end of the movie, a giant chestburster comes out of both of their chests.
Well, I like a surprise ending.
Which may be metaphorical, I'm not sure. No, it is very much what it is. I was really surprised that you liked Imitation of Life, to be honest. So, I would say if you really wanted to prep yourself for this movie,
to be in the right mood, but I have a much broader range than people give me credit for.
Right. So. I would agree with that. I would say All That Heaven Allows, then see Far From Heaven, then see this. And it'll give you a bigger context of what's going on here.
Maybe.
It's quite dismissive, Richard.
That's the name of this podcast, of course, but
that's what Richard loves to do. He loves to give me the quiet, hard passes.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and get into The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 1. And Richard, I'll let you set that up.
Okay. Sorry, that was...
Looks like Richard got set up himself.
Okay, so I have to kind of give my history, because that's what goes into my review.
Okay.
Yeah. So the first Hunger Games movie, I did not like. Just going to say it flat out. I thought it was a terrible movie. I don't think the core idea of the movie is bad. I liked Battle Royale. I love children killing children. It's a good idea.
It's always a good time.
But the movie itself, I mean, it kind of shirked its responsibilities as being, you know, a study of children being violent to children. Like, it didn't do any of that. And so I didn't like the first film. Let's just go there. The second one, I kind of liked. It was dark and dreary. I can't remember a thing from it, though. Not a thing.
Yeah.
The third film I did not like, but I also can't remember a thing from, except for I remember the joke we were talking about PETA being a one of those Halloween decorations
for
that movie. That's the only thing I remember. So I don't have a glowing response to this. So coming into this movie, there's a lot of things that I don't remember. I kind of just skip over because I'm like, it doesn't matter. It ultimately doesn't matter. But I kind of ended up enjoying this one. So what the thing is we come back on Katniss, who is recovering from her Halloween decoration being upset at. She...
Oh, this is good.
Yeah.
I like where this is going.
And so she's going on some revenge trip to kill this President Snowfellow, who I will say, this Sutherland, not Kiefer,
but Donald.
Donald. Yeah.
Okay. This Sutherland, he really, really does. I actually like him. He does really good in all these movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's really superb in this one. But basically they kind of have this toe-to-toe thing, but in the background, some shady other things are happening in the propaganda game that has been going on in the last two films. This film has a lot more, like, there's a reason that things are happening and is going forward. And and the whole plot of it actually did deserve a whole movie. Talking to Dan, your husband, Mindy, he said something that I very much agreed with, which was that the first film didn't need a whole movie and this film did need a whole movie. So I ultimately, basically what happens is she goes on this revenge quest and does it turn out, shadowy music. And the rest, if you haven't seen The Hunger Games, you're probably one of like five people. You're probably not interested anyways or listening to this podcast. So,
or they've read the book and already know how it ends. They haven't seen the movie. So,
well, I mean, there's some interesting things going on here. And we mentioned previously that this is kind of coming off of all of this crazy terrorism news with ISIS and the stuff that's going on in in Europe right now in France. And it kind of brought a lot of gravitas to what's essentially a big, dumb explosion-y action movie. Because these movies do deal in extreme ideologies and sort of the wars of the underclass versus the establishment and all of these things. And so it drudges up, you know, the current events up all of this. I don't know. I would say.
Well, the light terrorism kind of like elements in there, too, are a little.
Right.
They feel a little strange. Yeah, I can admit that. My feeling was like, literally in the middle of the movie, I was like, I don't know if I can feel if I give a shit that much about the violence happening because there's all this real violence in the world. That was my reaction.
Yeah. Oh,
but it
okay,
seems like you guys, well, no, you guys had another reaction.
Mine was more of a transference. Yeah. I kind of felt like I honestly, as silly as it is, like I've seen three movies about how terrible the capital is and how they're starving people and making them kill each other in these ridiculous reality game shows. And then at this movie, because of these events, I'm like, I found it a little difficult to root for the rebels.
Yeah.
Like it just because of the current events. And I'm not saying that anyone should, I'm not going to consider that in my overall assessment or review of the film, but it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've read all the books, so I had the foreknowledge going into it of the last like 20 minutes, the big event that happens at the end. So I have to kind of agree with that. Like, it's sort of like, do the means justify, like, how can you justify this sort of violence that you're perpetrating in order to, I don't know. Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Do you guys think that it is trying to, because I thought it was trying to kind of.
No,
kind of talk about what does the violence justify the means? Because you see kind of the aftermath of this PETA character, you see. You know, all these characters and how it divides them, you know, the violence, like, does it justify, I guess. That's what I did think this one had a little bit more than the other movies, because it had some stronger subtext.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that one of the interesting things about this movie in particular, they've kind of been hinting at it as the movies have gone on, but this one really, like, commits to this idea of, like, it's not a hero story necessarily anymore. It's a little messier than that.
Yeah.
And it gets, you know, the allegiances start to split in interesting ways. And the way it plays out in the finale is actually both really, really satisfying and really, I would say, shockingly brave for such a mainstream movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could have easily seen Hollywood being really nervous about that ending and saying, let's do something a little cleaner. Let's do something a little more pat that doesn't raise as many questions.
Well, I think the people who are the fan of the franchise, probably there would have been a lot of backlash.
Oh, yeah, they would have revolted.
They
would have stormed Beverly Hills.
Yeah, the Hollywood capital.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really interesting from being a fan of the franchise and having read all the books and, you know, been to all of the movies and really kind of tracked this, just to see the way that they played the marketing for this film. Mm-hmm. I felt it was very downplayed. Given how, like, the franchise started, like, they were just, like, pimping the first Hunger Games movie all over the place. And, you know, it was really this whole, you know, young adult, you know, they were trying to hook all of these young adults. And this movie was very, like, with each film, they had a whole soundtrack where, Taylor Swift wrote three songs, you know, and this movie, there was no soundtrack pre-released. There was no, like, pop songs attached to it. There wasn't even really a like score to speak of. So I felt like that really kind of hinted at the gravity and the serious nature that they were trying to kind of project with this particular entry.
Right.
Well, I was wondering too, though, if maybe besides, I do think that's part of it, but also, I mean, if they were making money on the Taylor Swift songs, I'm sure that would be part of this one. I don't know how they you know, shoehorn those in.
Oh, but, yeah.
But maybe that kind of old style Star Wars kind of make a cup and a plate and everything and bed sheets and towels, mm-hmm. and
yeah,
so on and so forth. Maybe that doesn't work anymore for this crowd.
Well, I feel like I've noticed that trend with a lot of young adult franchises that I've, you know, that I've partaken in. That the first film, the first couple films, there's like that big, you know, push to get all of the merchandise out there, and by like the third film that they split into two movies, so it's the fourth film, it's like they're just kind of like, we're sort of done with that and we're like moving on to the next big thing. So I don't know if it was a combination of that or if they were like, you know, this is a very serious subject, you know, and they didn't want to try to make it a cash cow, or maybe they pumped all the cash out of it and they were just ready to move on. I'm not quite sure what it was, but it was just kind of surprising to me that that had been the trend for the last couple movies.
I was just going to say, I think by this point, the movies kind of sell themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Like, you have three other movies that have sort of built this momentum. You don't really need to have a huge hit soundtrack, which really is kind of an old model. And that's like, mm-hmm. very 90s kind of thing to have the big pop soundtrack to go with it, where half the songs are never even played in the movie.
It worked for Guardians of the Galaxy, but that was very specific.
Yeah, that actually, mm-hmm. like had a thematic point of view and da da da. But it's also, it's a little hard to sell this material, I think, as an action figure, as a McDonald's toy. Like, mm-hmm. it just doesn't really, like, it's so... And I'll say this as a criticism to the movie. It's so, mm-hmm. fucking dour.
Yeah.
Like, I think that, you know, they're kind of well made. The last two in particular, I think, have been even more exceptional as far as that goes. I like the war aspect of the story much more than I like the reality show game thing,
mm-hmm.
Which I never thought really worked very well in those first two movies. But as it became more and more kind of a revolutionary story, I thought that dramatically was more interesting. However, nobody's having fun with this premise at all.
No, it's so, like, true.
It is the bleakest, most depressing movie franchise maybe ever. And I can't imagine, like, a group of 15-year-old girls who have a Friday and Saturday off, and they're like, you know what? Let's just binge watch all the Hunger Game movies this weekend. That's what we're gonna do.
But I think so they though, Cassidy.
Yeah, I have to tell you that I did. I did not binge watch them like in a marathon style, but I was like, oh, it's the last movie. Like, you know, I've made a habit in other franchises of like watching catching up, and
which me and Richard probably should have done.
No, it's cool. I did it for you guys, so you know.
Well, this is the thing is why I wanted to bring you on is because there's something that has been going on in the conversation. I felt like you add to more is that the YA book versus the marketing scheme versus the, mm-hmm. you know, the overall, even the presentation of these films.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume that the first Hunger Games takes its premise a little bit more serious as well.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
this well, last movie does. Because yeah. I know my wife, Jackie, she read the books and she really likes the first book. And mm-hmm. she says it's a lot more, it's a little bit more involved. Like, it's not as kiddy.
Exactly. When I first started reading the Hunger Games book, I was actually really surprised and kind of a little taken aback that this was marketed for young adults, because mm-hmm. it's really, the themes are very adult themes, and it concerns me. And at least at some of the showings that I went to see these young adults, like the big topics kind of like flying right over their head. And they're just like, oh, it's Katniss wears pretty dresses and she's in a reality show. Like, let's aspire to that. But really the themes are, you know, related to oppression and hunger and rebellion and terrorism. I mean, there's like a lot of really like heavy, deep right. stuff happening that I'm like, I wouldn't necessarily give that to a 13 or 14 year old unless I was having some conversations with them about that material. Cause I even just talked to my sister. She was going to take my niece, who's like 7. She's going to take her kids who 13, 8 and 6. I guess my niece is 6. I don't even know. And she was going to take her to see this movie. And I was like, I really don't think that, course I come to find out my niece has seen Aliens, so I was like, well, okay. I mean the whole scene where they're like in the sewer, I was like, oh, this, I was getting some nice
where the movie becomes The Descent for like 20 minutes. That was my favorite part, I'm not even gonna lie.
Same here.
I really enjoyed that too. My husband Dan and I were talking and I was just like, oh, I got so much like Aliens like feels mm-hmm. from that. It mm-hmm. was just the mutations were like super creepy, way better done than they were actually written in the book. The way, like, some of the stuff that's in the book is really, you know, is, like, the mutations were kind of dumb. Like, there's some dumb stuff in the series, but overall, there's actually really deep, like, very adult, very heavy themes throughout mm-hmm. the whole franchise. It's the most depressing movie marathon you will ever
like. Well, which you can have. I mean, my thing about this is a lot of times, like, people get YA kind of confused with, because there's actually another subgenre specifically aimed at like 12 to like 15 year olds,
mm-hmm.
and there's one for even younger kids than that. Right. There are sections,
the supernatural romance versus this, which is like more dystopian.
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, there's like age groups. Like, young adult is really really aimed at like 16 to 20.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like people that, oh, comic books are for kids. Well, actually, mm-hmm. the comic book market is actually published for people between 15 and 24. Males is predominantly what they were looking at. So it's sort of like a weird way to kind of like when somebody is like, oh, my baby, and they're talking about their 17-year-old boy, I always feel that very strange, because I'm like, this dude is taller than me. He has more face on his hair or more hair on his face. But,
he's got a big face. OK,
yeah, he's got a huge face.
His face is huge.
Is not a child. And so like the YA, I think sometimes gets stigmatized and kind of like, oh, it's for children.
Yeah.
And that's not really necessarily the case.
Yeah. You know?
And so I kind of thought that was, I always found that very strange and kind of the interplay between young adult and like the perception of what young adult is.
Yeah.
Right. I think actually some of that nuance though might be lost on Hollywood who are making these movies. I think that they see a model that works, Twilight being one of them, The Hunger Games being the other one. And I think, you know, sometimes they try and meet somewhere in the middle, which is usually even more awkward. And I think that I don't think they understand that they're, oh, you can kind of play a slightly younger. Actually, the series that's probably done that the best has been the Harry Potter series, because it kind of grew up with the characters.
Yeah, I was actually about ready to say that, which is perfect. I mean, that's with the readership kind of grew up along with it. So by the time you get into like the Deathly Hallows or whatever, it's like, yeah, like the youth are ready for that material. I mean, right. I don't know if that.
Well, they
Twilight. I don't want to touch that one.
Well, it's sort of weird, though, because I mean, like the marketing, it is geared towards like a 12 or 13 year old,
mm-hmm.
but like the material is not. And so it's a very strange. It's weird because I feel like the marketing scheme is what really is dumbing down a lot of
the content,
a lot of well, not I mean, just IPs in general.
Yeah,
I don't feel like it's like, how can we market this as opposed to what is the importance of this?
Right.
Mm hmm.
And so it's sort of, I guess that's how I found this the most, it's just strange. I mean, this gets kind of off of the movie, but the movie is, like we were talking about, it talks about some pretty, like, the effects of violence on society.
I think it plays into a comment you made earlier about how the original Hunger Games movie really, like, cheated. It didn't show you kids killing kids. Like, it turn the camera away from the violence. So there was a suggestion of violence, but it wasn't actually portrayed. And I think that that's something that this film does really well.
Yeah.
Is shows, I mean, it shows you like, the, I mean, it shows you everything. Well, like you see some pretty intense stuff happening.
Well, we're all from a similar generation. And like we grew up as, you know, they marketed rated R movies to us.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Well, I watched RoboCop like when I was like five.
Well, and even the movies that were marketed towards kids, like The Goonies, I mean, that has swearing in it. And, you know, there's sexual joke. I mean, there's
a dead body in a freezer.
Yeah, come on.
Well, but I mean, so with all that kind of like with our generation, it's very weird to look at like kind of like the
Disneyfication.
Exactly, that's going on now, because like even if you talk about like Edge of Tomorrow, which we talked about a while ago.
Oh, I love that movie.
I love that movie. The movie's really good. But then I felt very strange because I don't understand why they didn't just show violence in that movie. It was geared towards adults.
Mm.
Like it seemed even a little like tame for what it needed to be.
And oh, so, they got to hit that PG-13 sweet spot.
Yeah, it's a lot of what it has to do. And who knows really what hit the cutting room floor we'll never be able to see. Or maybe it's on the Blu-ray now or something. But
but it's weird because I was having this thought because as I was playing Fallout this weekend.
Yeah, like gotta work the Fallout reference.
How many kids are playing that? First of all, yeah, I do have to work the Fallout reference. It's in my brain. But I was thinking about how violent that is.
Yeah.
And like, are we just kind of subjugating where we can get our violence and where we can get our sex? Because I mean, the internet has plenty of that versus, and now we have this just diluted version of what film can be because of all this. Like, I don't know.
Well, and I think that when you hide the violence, then even more, the young people that are seeing it fail to understand the implications of violence. Like if you hack somebody with a saw, like they're head's gonna split apart like that. I just see that disconnect, and I totally agree that they kind of neutered this franchise a little bit because of that.
I want to make a few points, a little bit more direct criticism of the movie, because while I admire a lot of it, I can't say that I entirely loved it. For some of the same reasons of the other movies, but a little bit what I was talking about, it just being utterly joyless. I also thought that it kind of is weirdly paced. It kind of moves in fits and starts. I was thinking to myself, this is the nerdiest joke to ever make, so please feel free to lay free the crickets. but it's structured like a Pixie song. It's like quiet, quiet, loud. Throughout the entire movie.
That was a pretty musically nerdy.
There you go. There it was.
No, that's pretty awesome.
And the quiet parts are almost like the movie like falls asleep until these gigantic things end up happening. And it's like, I think 2:16 or something like that.
Yeah.
I think it probably could have been shaved down to an even 2 or 1:45 even.
Well, if I had my way, it would be shaved down. Well, it wouldn't be shaved down.
70 minutes.
No, just, well, yeah, that too. But it would just be expanded to just be that big long sewer scene and them running.
Right.
Because that was superb.
Yeah.
One of my criticisms is while I like Jennifer Lawrence, for some reason in these movies, I don't think she's particularly good.
I think she makes it up weird... by the tone.
Well, she also makes these weird faces. Like when they do they hold the camera too long. And she makes these really big melodramatic like faces once in a while, and I'm just like, this really just took me out. I'm like, I like literally laughed, and Jackie looked at me and like, why are you laughing?
Oh my god,
Richard. I'm sorry, I can't.
I do want to note, since I read the whole Mockingjay book, and it's probably out of the whole series maybe my least favorite in terms of the pacing, because there just is a lot of that, like, Katniss goes out to do something, she gets injured, she goes back to the infirmary. Katniss goes out to do another thing, she gets injured, she goes back to the infirmary. Like, there's that is actually in the source content, so I can kind of see why, you know, they were trying to drag out the runtime of the movie, so they're like, well, let's just do everything that was in the book, and that does not necessarily translate to the best pacing for a film.
I will say one thing about the splitting up the last book thing, though, which generally I'm against because it's a money grab and it makes for saggy movies. Mm-hmm. I will say that it did aid in the character arc of the Julianne Moore character, though, because I think she's barely introduced in the second movie, and they really start to build her character up in the third movie. So if that had all just been one movie, that entire arc with that character, I'm not sure if I would have bought it as much as being able to sort of let it breathe as much as it did between the two movies.
Well, you also kind of get kind of more of that relationship with Snow, I think, because I think it's both of those characters. You need that kind of, because this third movie really becomes a revenge plot. That's all it is her, I'm going to kill this motherfucker. And
but a messy revenge plot.
Yeah.
So it, again, I think overall this is one of the better ones of the franchise, but I have a hard time with the franchise in general. So it's sort of a weird, I don't know, for me it was a weird watch. And I'm not the person I think they're trying to sell this to.
Right.
Really?
I mean, you do like a lot of...
the subject matter, yes. The subject matter, people were like, you would love the books. But but the movies, I know that they were.
Yeah, I've kind of had a weird relationship with the movies too, and I'll just say, I'll chalk it up to what I've always said about this. It just isn't my Star Wars. It's just not my Star Wars. I get that it's definitely somebody's Star Wars, and it's going to be their thing for the rest of their life, and it's going to be really formative for them growing up. But you know, ultimately. I've only been able to care so much about this, but there's some definitely interesting stuff that goes on through all of them, and accumulatively, it's a kind of an impressive series.
I don't think it's going to be anyone's Star Wars, honestly, if I can be perfectly candid, because I don't think it has, like you said, any element or many elements of joy. Like, it's pretty, it's pretty depressing, and I don't think people are like, oh, the saddest parts of Star Wars are my favorite. you know, I see more of like this generation that's come after us. I think like Harry Potter is kind of their Star Wars. Like, people love the hell out of that series for good reason, because the archetypes are kind of match a little bit more to like the Star Wars universe. Mm-hmm. You've got a really clear good and evil, whereas this franchise is very much about complications. It's about, you know, Katniss really doesn't know, like, if she trusts the rebels or, you know, the the capital, and you know, it's really also kind of about PTSD, and I can't see an entire generation really like latching on to how awesome and moving, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome is. So
well, there you go. Well, good. I'm glad we had you on specifically for this conversation. But I'm also going to be interested to hear what you have to say about our Netflix homework.
Oh God.
Dish, which I assigned last week because for all of October, we were getting really moody and arty and I wanted to go into something a little light and frothy. So, do you want to describe the basic plot mechanics of Soap Dish?
Oh, I have to make a confession.
You didn't watch it?
So Jessica Jones came out on Netflix. And I pretty much spent the entire weekend watching Jessica Jones.
But you've seen the movie before.
I've seen the movie.
Has a good reason. I mean, I've seen the movie too, but Cassidy wouldn't listen to reason.
So I have to apologize. I did not do my homework. I feel terrible.
That's okay. I'll try to quickly synopsize this, and then we'll get into it. Basically, this is a screwball comedy about the inner workings of the soap opera genre in the early 90s. It stars a really big cast of a lot of character actors. We have a really young Robert Downey Jr., Kevin Kline, Sally Field is the main character, really young Elizabeth Shue, Whoopi Goldberg, Terry Hatcher, Gary Marshall. And essentially the plot is that, you know, there's some, Sally Field is sort of the Susan Lucci, diva type, who runs the show, and she's been winning the daytime Emmys, every year in a row. And, there's some people working, some writers and some actors who are sort of conspiring against her, and they bring in, an ex-lover who was written off the show many, many years ago, played by Kevin Kline. And unbeknownst to them, unearths a lot of real life soap opera drama. Richard.
Cassidy.
What did you think of Soap Dish?
It's one of those Kevin Kline early 90s comedies. It's a little silly. It's lighthearted. It's kind of fun. A
lot of fast dialogue.
Lots of fast dialogue, big characters. And you know what? If that's what you're looking for, it's good. It is. It's kind of fun. I would probably just watch A Fish Called Wanda because I prefer that one. But
you know, when you said Soap Dish, I think I thought that you were talking about A Fish Called Wanda because they both have Kevin Kline, right?
Like right,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then they came out kind of around the same time.
Pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah. A Fish Called Wanda was 85 and it's got kind of, I mean, it's got, you know. I think it's a little bit better, but it's also kind of got a heist plot, so you right. kind of get into it in a different way.
But they're both kind of farces, and yes. they get really kind of big and campy.
The characters are very, how they do the characters are very similar. Like, Kevin Kline between this one and A Fish Called Wanda, they're both these pompous, kind of dickish characters. Right. Like, I mean.
But also kind of blowhards and thick-skulled.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, it has its similarities, and if you're looking for like a new version of that movie, then this one is fun as well. But I mean, overall, it's just I think it's a little bit the humor is a little bit more easy and kind of convenient, and it doesn't necessarily do as much as A Fish Called Wanda does. The characters just aren't quite as interesting. I do think it's interesting the weird where they bring up about like Greek tragedy.
Yeah.
And soap operas, but
well, yeah, I mean, essentially the big joke their long joke that they play up to is that the lives of these characters end up mirroring the plots of soap operas, which is maybe a little trite, but also I kind of fell for it. Like, I thought this movie was just kind of a delight, like a tiny little light morsel of a delight. Zero calories.
Well, I mean, specifically after our horror month, I was kind of dissatisfied, Richard. Like with it. Ours, not mine personally, but ours, just because, oh my gosh, it was so arty.
It got weird.
Way too arty. It got a little too
it got weird.
It definitely got weird. Yeah. yeah, maybe there was a little bit of recovery from that as well. I think Sally Fields is really good in this movie. I mean, she gets to just, like, you know, stomp around and devour the scenery.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
And just play really big, and she's all shoulder pads and big hair and giant campy performance. And I can't think of her name. Catherine Moriarty, is that her name?
Is that the Montana character?
Kathy Moriarty, Montana, who was in, she has, like, the really deep smoker's voice. She was in Raging Bull and Casper.
Yes, yes. Okay.
Yeah. She plays her, like, you know, kind of bitchy thing that she does, and she does it pretty well here. I say that as a way that she has been casted, not
not a personal
no, like that is her
personal dig,
like that is her the character archetype that she plays. And she, you know, certainly playing it up. I actually, weirdly enough, it's always interesting to watch really old Robert Downey Jr. performances when he's not that good.
Mm.
And there's a little, he's not
binge is going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was plenty of that. And he gives a speech about towards the last third of the movie. Like, he's like accusing the Sally Field character of being out of control on drugs and how she needs to be fired because she's out of control. It's like, I know that you are so high on who knows what right now.
I wonder if he goes back to these performances ever.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, this kind of, you know, I'll confess, I like screwball comedies. I like movies like Some Like It Hot and Doris Day Richardson movies.
Right. More picky about it, but I don't know why. I mean, that's not even true because I like a lot of whatchamacallit, like Parsons. Horrible Bosses and Anchorman.
But yeah, well, that's more kind of absurdist, kind of broad comedy, where this is a little bit more about the character interactions, a little bit more about the dialogue, and
there's a lot of broad. I would say this is pretty broad.
Well,
humor.
Yeah, it's definitely not. But you know, people don't start talking to dogs and people killing each other with tridents and that kind of stuff.
Well, that probably would have made it a little better.
Man, that's not the movie I remember.
I'd say that the first third kind of has a really slow start, and I think the movie kind of takes a little too long to get to the meat of it. I think the movie really starts in earnest when Kevin Kline's character is introduced. And he could have been introduced probably about 20 minutes earlier. But I just enjoyed it for what it was.
No, I don't think you're wrong. It's a decent for what it was. I just wasn't. when I specifically was given the task to watch this about a year ago,
right.
It was like at a family thing. And I get when they don't want to watch, you know, oh, come on, you guys don't want to watch Alien? This is uplifting.
It's kind of uplifting. I don't know.
I'm sure they... it is, in that sense, yes. I had to watch this horrible, horrible romantic comedy. And so right after that, they had me watch this, and I just was not having it.
Right.
And so I kind of came in and out, and I wasn't really watching it very well. And then when I sat down and watched it again right now, I felt better about the about the film, but I still had that tinge of the first time I watched it.
I mean, it definitely has an abrasive style.
Not even the style. It's just kind of more like, at the end, it's just a little convenient. And
right. Like, it doesn't
really go anywhere.
Yeah, it doesn't really have a grand statement. It's more just a big send up of the genre. But
if there's a better version of this that I do like a lot, like A Fish Called Wanda,
yeah,
then I'll probably just watch that. And this one will just be like, and I'll forget about it and we'll go back to it.
Or like a Some Like It Hot or His Girl Friday or, you know, the movies of which it references.
Right.
Well, cool. What do you have for the show next week, Richard?
For Thanksgiving, I've assigned Dark Star, H.R. Geiger's World.
Sorry.
It's a documentary about him and his art and what it means. So, you know, while you're eating your turkey, you can think about xenomorphs and China mountains and whatever else is in his dark mind. But
right,
that's what I've assigned.
Well, I like H.R. Geiger's art a lot. In fact, actually, I believe for Halloween... and I haven't changed it yet, even though we're halfway or more than halfway through November. My main picture, the head photo or whatever on Facebook is a H.R. Geiger painting.
Yeah, you're pretty Geiger-esque.
And then I have a picture of my face done as a Peanuts character for my main profile picture. So they go together really well.
Well, it speaks more volumes than
Yeah, that's
than
essentially
think.
Everything you need to know about me is these two photos.
I like it. Good juxtaposition.
Mindy, thank you again for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad I could talk young adult at you guys.
Right. And I really liked having your perspective on all of that. And I hope that everything goes well with your book. And that you continue to both write and see it through to publication.
Thank you.
And like I said, we will include the link to that like online purchase thing that you have going on.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, that you can share.
If you share that information with me, I'll put that on Twitter and I'll put that on our Facebook as well as on our Podbean when I post the episode up.
Well, the name is Metal Heart too.
Yeah, I was like, I don't think I ever said the name of the book.
You could you can probably Google that shit.
Find it on the Googles. Let's see. Actually, I don't think that's the first thing that comes up. So don't just Google that, and it'll probably take you to some weird H.R. Geiger like porn. Right.
Do a deep Google dive, and eventually you'll find it.
I think if you just do Metal Heart Ink Shares, it'll probably pull up. So for the kiddos that like to do the Googles.
Cool. And do you have like a Twitter or anything like that that you would allow people to follow you on?
Yeah. My Twitter handle is McMindyC, and
because you're a rapper.
Basically.
Actually, she is she's really the whole group kind of does a lot of karaoke. Mm-hmm. They force me, but however, she does rap and she's very good at it.
Yeah, that's kind of my secret superpower.
It's true.
Awesome.
I'm really good at rapping, but.
Represent PDX.
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, if anybody wants to talk about anything that we talked about on the show, if you have an opinion about Soap Dish or the Dark Star documentary, not the John Carpenter movie, or Carol or Mockingjay Part 2.
Or Glitter Beards.
Or what?
Glitter Beards.
Or Glitter Beards. Yeah, apparently that's sweeping the niche, so...
For real? Have you guys actually met anyone who's done that, though?
No, I saw an article said that it's happening in Portland, though, and I linked Richard to it because I'm sure he wants to get on that.
Yeah, before it becomes a trend.
Yeah, you have about 2 weeks.
I actually have seen somebody with a bunch of glitter in their beard, but it was before all these articles. So I thought, I was just like, that dude has a lot of glitter in his beard. I wonder what that's about.
And that guy did it right. He jumped on and off at the right times.
Exactly.
But anyway, if you have anything to say about any of that, go ahead and email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook, where we post our news articles and our episodes at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Our Twitter is @jabberpodcast, all one word. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio, as well as player.fm, as well as the Zune and Pocket Cast and Windows Podcast Network. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also read my other reviews and other stuff I've contributed to the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. You can see Richard's scribblings that he's occasionally done over at his blog, rdwally.weebly.com. And be sure to check out Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa at their... incredibly infrequent podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, at quartercrisis.podbean.com, as well as Brad's new literary blog, Panel and Frame, that he does over at the Medium website. So check that out. I have a piece on there as well. Listen to Leland, our friend from Olympia, Washington, at his podcast, dampercast.com, and check out me on Patrick and Dennis's Almost Educational. This Thursday, they'll be posting up the episode we did on nostalgia.
I'll probably listen to that one, actually.
Not just because I'm in it?
No, because I listened to Almost Educational.
Yeah, it's a great show. And also be sure to listen to Patrick's other podcast that he does with his dad over in Detroit, Make Dad Read Comics. one of my favorite podcasts. All right. Again, thank you for coming on, Mindy.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was a blast. You guys are awesome.
We'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one.
Bye. All right, thanks. Bye.